The Venturi's Voice podcast brings together some of technology's brightest minds to discuss all things leadership, technology, and staffing. Keep the conversation going in the Venturi's Voice Slack group and have the opportunity to meet some of our amazing guests. You can download Venturi's Voice via iTunes or via the Venturi Group website at venturi-group.com. Today's guest is Nesta Jenkins, the Director and Head of Diversity and Inclusions at IAC Applications. Like I was saying just before we started there, it's really amazing to have you on the show. When I found out that I was having you on the podcast, it was just like immediately so much that I kind of wanted to ask you about. So first of all, thank you so much for taking the time.
Absolutely. Thank you for speaking with me and allowing me to share some information with you.
Yeah, no, I'm really looking forward to it. And, it's probably silly of me, really, but I don't normally start off by kind of getting some context on the people I have on the show as background. Probably silly of me, really. I don't know why I don't do that more. I think because I just get giddy and want to dive straight in a lot of the time.
Right.
But I think in this instance, I think it's really interesting to me to learn a little bit about kind of your background, where you come from, because I think, especially when we're going to talk about the topics that we're going to get stuck into, I think it's always really compelling to discover where one's from and where they kind of built their perspective and outlook on things from.
Of course. Yeah, definitely.
So, how did you build this great passion that you have around kind of diversity and people, from the very beginning, I suppose? Was it something that was, I suppose, part of your upbringing and something that you've always kind of had a passion about without knowing that it would potentially be a career option?
Yeah, it's definitely something I didn't know I had a passion for, but it's something that I've been doing my entire life, which is very interesting. So I grew up in a predominantly Caucasian neighborhood in Rhode Island, and I had attended a predominantly Caucasian school, so I was probably one of three Black students in the school. So there was not much diversity at that time. And we were also the only Black family in my neighborhood at the time. So we actually experienced a lot of racism, extreme racism, actually, of, you know, my mother being stopped in our driveway and the police officer asking her, "Ma'am, are you lost?" And my mother saying, "No, I'm not lost. This is my home." To, you know, being called very derogatory words while I was in school, like African monkey and just really mean, you know, things. And I remember, you know, coming home and telling my mom about it and being really upset and sad, and her saying to me one day, I did not bring you in this world to mope and complain. She says, "You go back to that school and create change." And this is when I was in middle school. So I remember looking at my mom like she was crazy. Like, how do I create change? First of all, I'm young. You know, I'm in a predominantly Caucasian school where I'm only one of three Black students. So how do I do that? And so I started thinking about that deeply. And that's what made me run for president of the freshman class. I ended up, you know, making it as president of the freshman class. And the number one thing that I wanted to focus on was the one common thing that everyone shares or had shared in the school at that time. And it was, we all feel excluded. You know, at one point in our lives, we all experience that. So it could potentially be if, you know, you're not smart enough, or you don't think that you're smart enough for mock trial or decathlon, you know, one of the after school activities, or not athletic enough for the football team, or, you know, or not pretty enough for the cheerleading team. So everyone had felt some form of exclusion. And for me, it was the color of my skin. And so I could have easily, you know, got super upset about it and stormed in the school and said, "Hey, this is what I'm going through. This is what I'm experiencing, and everyone should, you know, feel bad about it." but I knew that that wouldn't be as effective. So I really had to talk about how everyone felt excluded and then be able to share my story. And I tell you, after that experience, the school was so open and receptive to having these deep conversations and unpacking some of these things. The students were open to it. And that was sort of my first opening into D&I before it was called D&I. So that's how I pretty much got started. After that, I, you know, ran my own company for a while. It was a casting company. And I had ended up, you know, splitting from my company and ending that. And so transitioning into corporate America was a bit challenging, because when you're a business owner and you're used to, you know, sort of being in your own world and calling the shots, it's hard to transition that now then into, you know, having a manager or someone sort of, you know, wanting to tell you what you need to do, as opposed to you being as creative as you can be. So it's funny, because I started looking into consulting opportunities. And so I had said to myself, well, you know, if I'm consulting, then it's almost like I'm running my own show, my own business. And I started consulting for IAC Applications, which is the organization that I work for now. And in the matter of a couple weeks, they had, they wanted me to join the team full time as a recruiter. And I had accepted. And it was because of the culture and the experience there. And ever since then, my role has grown significantly. And now I'm head of diversity and inclusion. And it's been such an amazing experience.
It was, yeah, I mean, first of all, thank you for kind of giving some context there. You know, it's, there's a lot to kind of pick out from that. I think, first of all, you know, it must take a great deal of kind of emotional intelligence, certainly at a young age, to be able to kind of identify your surroundings and, you know, behave in accordance and in a way that doesn't involve, you know, things like anger, you know, and to be kind of sensible in your approach and understand that, you know, there's an education piece that needs to be put in place here. You know, it's, you kind of understood why there was that kind of seclusion element to it, you know, and I think that took a great deal of emotional and just in general intelligence, especially at a young age. So I think, you know, clearly you had those traits early on that have served you well into the current position that you're in now. I wanted to ask as well about that kind of transition, a little bit more about the transition from, you know, owning your own business and calling the shots. You know, do you think that that time where you kind of ran your own shots, you were kind of secluded and it wasn't something that was as obvious to you? You know, the questions around diversity and, you know, seclusion and things like that. Because you were in control, you know, of your own destiny. And were those kind of, was that experience that you had when you were younger, was that kind of reborn when you actually had to go back into corporate America? Was there kind of that period in time when you were running your own shots where, you know, it wasn't as in your face, perhaps?
You know, it's interesting, because I feel like it was something that was always in my face. It was something that I was always focused on and was a mission of mine. So when I was running my own business and I was a casting director, casting talent for New York Fashion Week, runway shows, and different MMA fights and boxing matches and all of that, different events. The reason why I formed my own business is because I wanted to create a safe space for women to be able to be artistic in their own form, not be harassed. Because in the entertainment industry, there can be a lot of that. It's very male dominated. And so, you know, many women and some men feel that pressure. And unfortunately, the safe space that I was you know, trying to create, I felt like it was being taken advantage of, not only just with clients, but also with talent. Because when folks want some folks, when they want an opportunity, it's, they sort of want to bypass, you know, the middleman to get what they want. And that's not always the best route, to take. So it has always been something that I have been focused on. When I moved into the corporate setting, we had immediately formed employee resource groups. And employee resource groups are pretty much specialized groups. So there is a people of color group, LGBTQ group, and women in tech group. And these groups are supposed to be safe spaces for people. And they can be, you know, they create a sense of community. But what I instantly started to observe, and I think my sort of early childhood experience for this, is I saw that those groups were essentially segregated groups. And I started, and a lot of companies believe in them pretty heavily, employee resource groups. And I started looking at them and I said, well, how is it that these groups are sharing content with each other? How are they sharing content with other people that don't feel like they identify or fit in those groups? And how are we really able to create change if we have those types of groups? You know, how is that truly inclusive? So there's a lot of companies that, you know, say, okay, we're focused on inclusion. We're all about inclusion. But is that truly inclusion if you don't have men a part of those conversations as well? And which is why we actually ended up removing employee resource groups. So we no longer have them. We just have one group now called Diversity Ambassadors, where every single person in the company and the organization can be a part of this. And we have conversations every single day about everything pertaining to D&I. So everyone is getting this information. You know, no one is excluded. And I'm thankful again to my early childhood experience and sort of implementing a program like that while I was in high school, able to see that even in the workplace and make some changes. And it's a bold change. You know, a lot of companies aren't open to doing that. But what I like to do is an exercise with when I'm speaking. At different speaking engagements, I like to do an exercise with the attendees, and I actually separate them into different groups, and I allow them to experience how it feels to be a part of a group like this, and how it feels to not be a part of a group, and feel that form of exclusion. And I actually had the last speaking engagement that I did at Panasonic. One of the attendees said, my organization believes heavily in employee resource groups. And she said, had you just, you know, talked about your company removing this, she said, I would have never believed that this could kind of be detrimental to an organization. She says, it wasn't until, you know, you did that exercise with us, and I was able to be a part of it and experience. She's like, now I want to see if we can make that change within our organization. So it was really cool to hear that and, you know, to see that as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing that IAC applications have sort of been so forward thinking with this regard. There's clearly still a lot of pushback from a lot of organizations, you know, large and small. I think just around HR and that whole kind of piece around culture in general, right? I think the feeling that I certainly get from executives and the pushback that we typically receive is that people are kind of obsessed these days with data. And I think that obviously data is incredibly important. I think it's always great to make good business decisions based on being informed by data. And you get these kind of culture shifts or these kind of D&I initiatives. And I think what a lot of executives struggle with is the sense that, well, why are we investing heavily in this? How is that affecting our bottom line? They want these kind of basic ROI, on things. And actually, interesting thing, the irony of that is that, you know, they have those same questions around the data teams themselves, right. Which is actually quite ironic. But that is, I think, where the pushback comes from is, well, right, well, why are we investing in this? How does that kind of impact our bottom line? And, right. You know, I think the logical person, you know, is saying that, you know, culture impacts people's performance significantly. But by just saying that, you know, I think it's one of those things where everyone is happy to kind of stand around and nod and agree on. But then when it comes to actually actioning that, it's kind of, you know, almost just like people are box ticking. And, you know, we need to try and convince people that, you know, there is evidence here that this will not only, you know, impact the health and wellness of the employees, but also, you know, it will probably impact the bottom line because the workplace is in a better state of mind, the culture is much better. And, you know, from my experiences, you know, I've lived in America for actually 6-7 years, and I lived in California and was working on a startup. And when we first got funding, we were in an incubator, which essentially is just comprised of like lots of different early stage startups, and not all of them make it, of course. And what I drew from that experience when, you know, years later, when I was trying to figure out, well, why did some make it and others didn't? Because there was always good ideas. There was never a shortage of good ideas. And the one thing that I was able to draw from that experience was the companies that had that kind of cohesion internally, the ones that had the strongest culture, the better dynamics. It was quite obvious to see that just from across the room with those type of companies, were the ones that inevitably went on and succeeded. And that was the only consistency from my experience that I was able to draw from and think that's the reason why that group of companies made it and that group of companies didn't. So for me, I've always felt quite passionately about it. But I've also been around people where I think no one will disagree that they think diversity is important. Well, maybe they will, I don't know. But, you know, for the most part, from people, certainly people in my circle, which, you know, might not be the best data source, but, you know, I think a lot of people will nod along and agree to it. But then, you know, actually action and they don't because they feel like the substance isn't there with it. You know, maybe you've experienced that yourself. And is there kind of, you know, a way where we can kind of retort to that?
Yeah. I think the biggest thing is, again, a lot of organizations have those employee resource groups. They need to be removed in order for us to see some change, because I think people tend to forget, especially people tend to forget that executives are humans too, right? So I hear a lot of HR leaders that are focused on D&I saying, you know, it's so challenging to get executives on board. How do we do this? And I say, well, you have to think of them as humans too. You know, they want to be a part of these conversations, but many of them just don't feel comfortable, or they don't identify with a particular group, right? When we look at the number of executives, or we look at even the race, you know, or the gender, it's predominantly white men. And, but they have to be a part of the conversation too. So we have to take a look at, are we including them? You know, and many of the times we're not. And so, and as a human being, if you're not included, say you're a kid and you're at the park and other kids aren't playing with you, you're going to just start playing alone, you know, that's the same concept. I feel like D&I, you know, it's a very, basic concept to get, but people make it much bigger than, you know, than it needs to be. And so again, I think the first step is definitely removing those ERGs. Second step is empowering executives, leaders to contribute to ongoing conversations, right? And I think the best way to do that is by utilizing different forums or Slack channels, so that it's an ongoing thing every single day. So a lot of companies want to focus on unconscious bias training once a year and then that's it. But how is that effective if there's not an ongoing conversation going on? It's almost as if I say to you, Andy, you just blinked. Now you're going to remember that you blinked, But let's give it an hour. You're going to forget that you blinked. It's just going to become natural again. And that's the same thing with, I feel, about unconscious bias training. I think the third step is asking them to be a part of programs and lead these programs. So at IAC Applications, we encourage executives to lead these fire chats or these panel discussions. They are fully on board and a part of these conversations. And then I think the final step is really empowering leaders and executives to define what diversity and inclusion means to them. So a lot of the times we talk about diversity and inclusion just in general, you know, about the bottom line or how to impact the business and the financial aspect of it. But really, what does it mean to you personally? And it's really about every single person being able to create their own story to see the value in that.
I think it is. I really do believe this kind of conscious unbiased training, right? Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I really do believe in that. I think, like you say, you're all subject as individuals to your upbringing. You know, you have a great base for decision making on this particular subject based on your kind of upbringing. You know, others that it was never as part of their upbringing, I'd probably include myself in that.
Yeah.
You know, that I wasn't aware, it wasn't my fault, I just didn't,
right.
Wasn't around it, right? You know, so until I moved into, you know, bigger metropolitan areas and experienced it in different environments and university and such. But, you know, this, either way, I'm a huge fan of the, you know, implementation of psychology into a lot of kind of business decision making in general, and obviously specifically in building a culture and its involvement with D&I. Even down to the kind of things like when we're hiring for jobs, there is a bias there. You know, if your recruiter is, you know, making up a job description or putting an advertisement out there, there is clearly like unbiased with that regard.
Right.
And there isn't kind of an art to that. And we're doing it and wondering, you know, why we're not getting more diversity and why we're getting similar sort of people applying for our jobs. But there probably is really a reason for that behind, you know, maybe the obvious numbers and, you know, the supply and demand in the market. There's probably, you're creating more of a, you know, a sharp edge by just the way that you're advertising things as well. Is that something that, you know, as your responsibilities now, that you really work closely with your kind of recruitment team and such on to ensure that, you know, those mistakes don't happen?
Yeah, I definitely do. But I think one of the biggest things is, you know, recruiters definitely need to attend more events that have different demographics in them. So really being able to understand each demographic, some of the challenges that they're facing, some of the type of roles that they're looking for can really help to sort of shape that job description and also can help bring more people on board. I was just thinking about this morning, you know, I love to see organizations get a little bit more creative with their job descriptions, you know, and instead of maybe posting a job description, what about a video? What about having the hiring manager of that particular role talking about how dynamic this role is, showcasing their personality? Because essentially the folks that are applying, one person's going to get to work with the hiring manager. So it'll be nice to get an in on who is this person? What do they value and what's important and exciting about this role? And really what people, especially diversity candidates, they want to be as innovative as possible. They want to be creative. Is there room for that? You know, and sometimes just a formal job description on paper doesn't really bring that out to light. You know, there's a ton of things we can do to attract diversity candidates, but if we want to attract all candidates, you know, I think it really comes down to being super creative. And we're in a world now that branding is really important. social media is very powerful, a lot more people on it. And that's a great way for different organizations to see more talent, you know, to see diverse talent flowing in.
It's quite obvious that you have like kind of such a great focus and a vision. But you know, on a kind of day-to-day basis now, what are the things that, you know, continuously kind of get you excited? And you know, what are the kind of the type of small wins that, you know, I suppose keep you engaged and motivated as well? Do you have any kind of examples like that?
My gosh, that's such a great question. I think some of the huge wins is when I see employees and executives in my organization leading these conversations. We recently had a conversation about gender equality, and one of the employees that's a part of the product team, she had led that, and it was a room full of men, probably about 25 men. We were the only two women in the room. And I was just like, wow, this is powerful. You know, that's the power of inclusion, you know, making sure that you're creating safe spaces for everyone to talk about these topics and have these hard conversations. I think the other win is having the ability to share what IAC Applications is doing at other organizations. So in the last 7 months, I've been able to speak at over 40 different events, which is a lot of talking. It's a lot of talking, but it's a major win because people are seeing us as thought leaders in the D&I space, and we're able to really showcase some of the great work that's being done, some of the challenges, the success stories, and really giving them some actionable steps to take to create the same wins within their organization. So, I mean, overall, I'm really proud of the employees within my organization. I can honestly say having a boss, you know, and I report to the chief people officer, she is super inspiring, and she gives me the ability to be as creative and innovative. When I took on the head of diversity and inclusion role, she didn't give me any restrictions. She didn't say, Netta, this is what you need to do or you can't do, or you have to stay within this guideline. She told me to drive it. You know, drive it, be innovative, be creative, and let's work at it. Because there's no blueprint around diversity and inclusion. Everyone's trying to figure it out. And so it's interesting because when I take a look at other job descriptions that focus on head of diversity and inclusion or VP of diversity and inclusion, you always see sort of this structure, and it seems a bit restrictive. And I'm like, well, if D&I doesn't have a blueprint, then why are they listing all of these things? You know, wouldn't you want that person to be as creative as possible to create some real results and change? And so I'm honored to be a part of an organization that really values my opinion and allows me to be innovative and creative.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? The very concept of the role being structured sort of defeats the purpose in itself. It's quite interesting, that, isn't it? The role in itself is certainly not a job title that is, you know, I suppose is obvious one to think of. And I'm sure there's still a lot of companies that probably don't have anything that's even remotely close to that.
Right.
Have you seen, you know, much of a change? I mean, it's obviously always quite difficult to do. I don't know if you keep your eye on this sort of thing, but have you seen kind of an uplift in, you know, similar types of roles? You know, what's your kind of senses on that?
Yeah, there's definitely an uplift of, you know, more roles around data science, artificial intelligence. Definitely diversity and inclusion is very, very popular. Learning and development is also very popular as well. So I've been seeing a large influx of roles around that. And of course, engineering, you know, folks are always looking for engineers.
Do you feel that kind of sense of responsibility? Because, you know, obviously we're seeing momentum build up in these kind of roles, right? But as, you know, I'm not saying you're necessarily early adopter, but relatively early adopter into a role like this and to have impact that you've, as you stated, proud enough to have had. Do you right. feel that kind of sense of responsibility to, you know, to have, go to and do these kind of, do podcasts like this to get the kind of voice out there and voice your opinion? Do you feel that, did you feel that sense of responsibility and kind of subsequently kind of pursued speaking, you know, arrangements and things like that because, you know, you kind of felt the weight and the importance to make sure that other people were considering this and building it into their future plans for the organization?
Absolutely. You know, this is something that I'm really passionate about. It's something that I've been focused on since I was in middle school, you know, before diversity and inclusion was a popular term. And it has been, you know, number one for me to share content. And I feel like that's the only way people learn. You know, if I wasn't speaking and spreading this knowledge with others, I would be doing myself disjustice and even my company, you know, the company that I work for, and other companies as well. You know, in order to see other people grow, it is at the end of the day, something that I'm really passionate about. So if, you know, if I can share some of the actionable steps that we're taking that we're seeing results from with another company and they see the same thing and it's creating change within the workplace, within our society, then I know that I'm doing a good job. And that's how I measure success for me.
Yeah, I think it's a good measure. Yeah. Ness, it's been really compelling talking with you so far. You know, I'm conscious of time as well. We typically go around half an hour, but I just wanted to kind of try and close the discussion on this. But, you know, if, you know, you were to speak to people who are either interested in following in your footsteps and working towards kind of a similar role, or, you know, people who listen to the show in, you know, head of tech positions and such, if you were to kind of speak to them directly and they didn't have something as formally in place as what your organization does, would you have any, you know, kind of advice for those people on, you know, one, how they can kind of pursue something like this, and two, like how to just kind of make those first steps and work towards getting something like this implemented?
Yeah, I think the first step is leadership. You know, having a conversation with their employees, having a town hall, and having just an open conversation about what D&I means to them, their own personal stories, and why it's important for the organization as well. I think that's the first step to really gauge how, you know, their employee base is feeling about it. And then after that, give me a call, connect with me, and I'd, you know, love to sit down with folks and share some insight. One of the things I'm working on right now is creating a webinar, and I'm also working on an inclusion workplace book to help organizations. So that's up and coming.
Yeah, always great advice. You know, always seek out, you know, external and people who've been there, done it before. I think it's the most obvious one, but ironically, the one that most people fail to do. So yeah, I think for obvious reasons, you'd be a great place to start for those people who are trying to get the wheels turning. Ness, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for taking the time. Hopefully we can do this again soon. It was really fun.
Yes, please. This was amazing. Thank you so much. You had such phenomenal questions. So
thanks for listening to the show. I look forward to hearing everyone's thoughts on this episode over on the Venturi's Voice Slack group. See you next time.